morning. Welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. New Mexico is experiencing one of its wettest springs in decades, thanks to a mixture of higher than average rainfall and snowpack. Farmers are expecting abundant crops, acequias are at capacity, and the Rio Grande is running 10 times higher than it was at this time last year. But so much water increases flood risks and challenges us to remain conservation-minded even as we make the best of this bounty. We are talking about New Mexico's high water year this morning, and we want to hear from you. Has all the rain changed your plans for farming or planting gardens? How are you remaining water conscious? Are you going to take advantage of the high river flows by river rafting or sailing on one of our state's lakes? Send us an email at letstalk@kunm.org or give us a call at 277-5866. Now, our first two guests this morning are Laura Paskus, a journalist with New Mexico Political Report who has written extensively on the state's water and environmental issues for over a decade, and David Gensler, chief hydrologist of the Middle Rio Grande Conservancy District. Hi, Laura and David.
Good morning.
Laura.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, guys, I want to say how nice it is to talk to you about an abundance of water for a change. Exactly how much more water than normal are we seeing in the state, Laura?
In the Rio Grande, like you mentioned, we're seeing about 10 times what we had last year, which last year was a very low year. This year is a very high year. But looking back, actually, John Fleck was posting about it on Twitter this morning. If you look back at flows of the Rio Grande in the 80s and 90s, they were bigger than what we're seeing right now. So these flows are really different and bigger from what we've seen in the recent decades, but it's not as though they're unusual in the historical record.
Okay. And how long is this level of water flow expected to last?
So I can let David talk about that a little bit more, but as I understand it, is we're looking at these robust flows through June.
Okay. And David, is that correct?
Yeah, thank you, Laura. We're probably, in terms of our snowpack, we're probably looking at about 130% of normal this year, give or take a little bit. So it's not an immense year. As Laura pointed out, there were a lot of years back in the mid-1990s, the 1980s, where we had some really big snowpacks. This is noteworthy because it's so much better than the last several years we've had. You know, it appears to be really big because we've had so many poor years.
It's like our first meal after being on a diet or something.
Exactly. and this one's going to go on a long time, too. One of the kind of the oddities, and every year is different. The amount of snow you get's different, and the way that it melts out is always different. One of the oddities of this one is the snow got in place by, about mid-April, and it's just stayed. Above 10,000 feet, everything that fell is still there.
Okay, and is that because of the cool weather we've been experiencing, or what is keeping it there?
It's been a combination of cool temperatures, and every time a little bit melts out, another little storm system comes through and puts it right back. So there was roughly 30 inches at Cumbres Trestle 2 months ago, and it's still there. And so I think this is going to make the river run all the way through June into July, maybe even quite a bit longer than that.
And is the state at this point, is it still considered to be in a drought?
I believe generally we're out of drought in most parts of the state. I haven't looked at any of the drought monitors lately, but back in March, I think I was looking at them, and we were coming out of drought pretty much everywhere.
When was the last time we came out of a drought? Do you happen to know?
I don't remember off the top of my head. Maybe Laura does.
Laura, is that something that you remember?
I'm not totally sure about when the last time we came out, but just this morning when they released the drought monitor, we had a what's considered more of a severe drought condition still up in northwestern New Mexico, and we've come out of that. So there's still drought conditions in about a third to a half of New Mexico, but it's not as severe as it was. And that's in part the reason we're still in sections of the state are still in drought, even though we've had so much snow and the runoff is nice, is that we have this sort of long-term buildup of deficits where the soils are thirsty, the forests are thirsty. You know, we don't just snap out of it because of one good year.
Now, one of the what would you call it, like a canary in the coal mine species is the silvery minnow. We're always talking about the silvery minnow and its water needs. How is it doing this year?
So I've been kind of checking in with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service every once in a while, and this is a good year for the silvery minnow. What the fish really needs, aside from sort of regular flows throughout the year, is it needs a nice springtime surge of water at the right time and the right temperature so that it can spawn. And then it kind of needs places where the larva and the young fish can hang out. And in part due to some great restoration projects along the river, there are now sort of more places for this overbanking and these backwaters to kind of occur. And this year, this has happened out along the river at all, you can see where this great habitat is this year for the fish. And so they're anticipating that there will be a nice boom in the fish's population this year.
And now, David, why is the minnow an important species to kind of keep an eye on?
Well, it's important to us in because it affects our water management. I mean, it's a federally listed species, and we have a biological opinion that influences how we operate. And there are things that we can do with our water system that make conditions worse for the silvery minnow or make systems or make the situation better for the silvery minnow. And so it does have quite an influence on how we operate, how we store water, how we release water, how we divert water. And as Laura mentioned, it looks like it's going to be a good year for the minnow. 2017 was a good year for the minnow. There were a lot of minnows out there in the river at the end of 2017. 2018, we had a very, very low runoff, one of the worst on record, and we had virtually no silvery minnow reproduction that year. And that's tough on a species that has a short lifespan. They need to reproduce at least every other year.
Now, are they reproducing at a great rate this year? Are their numbers exploding, or has this cold weather affected them?
Well, that's the funny thing. We think they're reproducing like crazy right now. But in really big water years like this, we see almost no eggs in the river. Because the minnows, like Laura said, they're out in these remote places. They get out into the backwaters where the water's calm and warm and there's a lot of nutrients, and they reproduce out there. And the people that are monitoring for silvery minnows can't find them.
So doing better, but... Well, we don't know for sure. We can't actually watch them. They're getting privacy this year.
Yeah. Past experience tells us they're doing great this year, but we won't know probably till October this year.
How are you enjoying this year's higher rain and runoff levels? Are you spending some more time in the bosque or along the rivers in your area or fishing in the mountains? Or are you getting ready to do some boating when it warms up? Give us a call and tell us about it at 277-5866. That is in the 505 area code. Or email letstalk@kunm.org. Now, David, the Middle Rio Grande Conservancy District is responsible for managing the waterways in the Middle Rio Grande region. This includes maintaining dams and other flood control and storage systems. So with the Rio Grande running at about 10 times higher than it was last year, what does that mean for the conservancy system? Does that bring out some new challenges for you guys? Or?
It's a change for us. We shift our operations in a year like this from really working hard to deliver water when there isn't much to deliver to taking care of our canals and keeping them functioning when there's so much water. And with that water comes a lot of sediment, comes erosion problems. It's a lot more maintenance effort for us. I've been telling people that we're doing first aid right now on our canals and levees. You know, erosion, we get bank sloughing, things start to happen. They're little things, but mm-hmm. It's like a cut. If you don't get out and take care of it right away, it gets infected and gets worse.
Right.
So we're doing a lot of maintenance this spring.
Can you tell me a little bit about the sediment issues? Like what results from, how does sediment result from like the increased water flow, and then what does it do to your system?
Well, we live in a very sandy valley, obviously, and little tributary inflows that happen throughout the year bring sand, gravel, and stuff down the arroyos, and it gets deposited in the river. And then we have low flows for an extended period of time, most of the last two decades, and that stuff builds up, that sediment builds up in the river channel. And then we have a bigger flow year like this, and it all starts to move. And a lot of places in the river right now, it seems like it's about one-third water, two-thirds sand moving.
Oh my.
you get down around our diversion dams where we're taking water out of the river, there's more sand sometimes than water coming into our canals.
So I just want to take a quick moment here to I want to get an idea of how is this year compared to average? Like, we're talking a lot about how it is compared to last year. What are we looking at in compared to an overall average of New Mexico's water flow?
Well, I think the problem is there is no such thing as an average year. Every year is different.
Okay.
That's the nature of the Rio Grande. It's a feast or famine river system.
Mm-hmm.
The average year is mythical. It doesn't exist. This is probably a wetter than typical year, but it's not extraordinarily wet given some of the events of the past, some of those record years in the 80s and the 90s. And you can go back in time and you can see that there's kind of a cyclical pattern of two or three decades of wet, two or three decades of dry.
Right. Okay. So not, we can be excited, but it's not that unusual in the long term.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a good year, but it's not extraordinarily high.
So I know that we have passed some milestones recently because of this increased water flow, including Article 7 restrictions of the Rio Grande Compact of 1938. Laura?
Yeah, so probably David would be better to talk about this since he's one of my sources who I ring up to talk about these sorts of things. But just to kind of give the thumbnail sketch is, you know, the Rio Grande Compact set the rules for annual deliveries and sharing the Rio Grande among Colorado, Texas, and New Mexico. And, you know, built into that agreement are all sorts of conditions. And one of them is that upstream water users aren't able to store water in certain places when levels in Elephant Butte Reservoir are below a certain threshold. And so the state was in Article 7 restrictions for about a year, I believe. And we just came out of them, which means the Middle Rio Grande Conservancy District can now be storing more water upstream.
Okay. And so, David, can you tell us what this means for the Conservancy District now that we have enough water to satisfy these requirements?
Well, it means we've got a chance to put a little water into storage to tide us over later this year or, with a little bit of luck, maybe somewhat next year, too.
Okay. How do you maintain a conservation mindset in a year of abundance? Do you have tips to share for making the most of your water use? Give us a call at 277-5866. And I did have another question just about what kind of impact does this flooding have on, you know, we hear a lot about native and non-native species in the Bosque. We just talked about the silvery minnow. Are there other species that that are being impacted here by this increased water level? David?
Well, yeah, almost all of our native species, whether they're plant or animal, somehow have evolved to include flooding. You know, flooding is a natural part of a desert river system like the Rio Grande. And they're all evolved to either tolerate it or, in a lot of cases, require it as part of their life cycle.
Okay.
So it's good for our bosque. A lot, our cottonwoods require periodic flooding to regenerate. It's healthy for them. It's not so healthy for some of the non-native species. So it helps to keep the system shifted in favor of the native vegetation. And it also has benefits in terms of, you know, fire reduces fire risk, for example. We've got lots of forest litter that builds up in the bosque, and periodic flooding like this helps to remove some of that forest litter, to get it to decay, to reduce some of the fire danger.
Okay, this is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. We want to hear from you. Have you experienced any benefits or challenges this year due to the heavy rains? Are you dealing with flooding? Or are you just happy to see nearby waterways at high capacity? Our number is 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM. We are also live tweeting the show, so send us your comments using the hashtag Let's Talk NM, and we're going to take a quick break.
The law firm of Rothstein Donatelli is committed to supporting KUNM, representing Native American tribes, people facing criminal charges, civil rights plaintiffs, and victims of sexual abuse. Info at rothsteinlaw.com. Support comes from the New Mexico Philharmonic, presenting a concert for champions, a night of American favorites, Saturday, May 25th at the Zoo. Gates open 6:30, concert at 8. Tickets available at nmphil.org.
A new round of tariffs have a number of tribes that trade internationally on edge. Several new policies and positions from the Trump administration affect tribally owned enterprises. We'll get a look at international trade and the potential trade war from a Native perspective. All this on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
Welcome back. I'm Ty Bannerman. This is Let's Talk New Mexico. We are talking about New Mexico's wet spring and what it means for our often drought-ridden state. And we're taking your calls, 277-5866, or email letstalk@kunm.org. I'm speaking currently to Laura Paskus, a journalist with the New Mexico Political Report, and David Gensler of the Middle Rio Grande Conservancy District. And one of the things I wanted to touch on was the infrastructure like dams and flood control measures. Given that our state is not typically known for flooding, are we ready for the kind of water that we're seeing this spring? David?
We are ready for it. Like I said, the Rio Grande is a feast or famine river system, and as a result, there are a lot of flood control features that have been built in the last century. U.S. Army Corps of Engineers operates Abiquiú Reservoir, Cochiti Reservoir, Galisteo Reservoir, Jemez Reservoir. All these things were built to protect the Middle Valley against very large volumes of water that can originate and come into the Rio Grande, and then they're all fully functional and will protect the valley from flooding. Plus, we have the levee system. Most people, a lot of people, don't realize that throughout much of the city, much of the valley in general, the Rio Grande is higher than the surrounding land. It sits higher than Old Town, for example.
Wow,
it
I had no idea.
Yeah, it sits higher than downtown. And there are levees that have been in existence for 85 years to prevent the river from coming out of its banks and flooding the lower-lying lands around.
Okay, now I'd like to welcome into the conversation Andy Otto, who is the executive director of the Santa Fe Watershed Association. Hi, Andy.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. Now, Andy, your organization is kind of focused more on the environmental side of waterways in the Santa Fe area. Most notably, this includes the Santa Fe River, which is often low to the point of near invisibility. How are things looking this year?
Well, of course, it's great. We have flows in the river, and people have noticed, which has been super, not only through downtown Santa Fe, but the flows have been enough to go on down through Agua Fria and some of the lower villages along the river.
And what kind of benefits does an increased flow in the Santa Fe River offer?
Well, besides the psychological or good feeling of it all, and the potential economic benefits from the tourism being more pronounced. Probably the biggest thing that we look at is the aquifer storage recharge that is happening with the situation where you have flows going as far down as we're having it go.
Okay, and you mentioned the tourism industry. I do have a quick question about that. What kind of impact does the river's flow have on that?
Well, the river flows right, next to the downtown, the plaza area. And so there's so many times people are in town and they're walking around, and for them to see a flowing river through town with the grassy banks and the benches and things like that, it's just sort of a pleasant place to go and see water flowing in the middle of the desert.
Now, you mentioned aquifer recharge. Could you explain how that works, what that is?
Sure. What we're looking at is, and this is something identified in the Bureau of Reclamation 2015 Santa Fe Basin Study, one of the challenges that we've had in Santa Fe has been the aquifers have been depleted for the last umpteen years, pick a date, 100 years, 70 years, something like that. And so what the whole goals have for the Water Utility Department, the City Water Utility Department, have been to recharge those aquifers, to bring them back up to levels as much as we can. And so that's what flows in the river and the arroyos do, as long as they're not catastrophic flows, flash floods.
Okay. And what sort of projects does your organization work on that can kind of help take full advantage of this year's abundant water?
So we have what we call rain gardens. They're bioretention basins, which we have built and are continuing to build around the watershed. They're basically capturing stormwater off of the streets and off of the roofs and letting them go into a basin where they can infiltrate back into the aquifer. And we put in plants and different, I'll say, soil mixes to help increase that infiltration. And the plants, of course, help filter.
Okay, I have a caller comment from Nora. She says a wet spring like this year creates a potential for extreme fire seasons in the future because of all the plants growing that can create fuel for fires. She says that now is a good time to start preparing for that by clearing ground cover. And my question to you guys is, how can folks prevent wildfires ahead of time, even in a year like this where it's really wet? Do you have an answer for that, Andy?
Sure. I'll go in a couple of things. Of course, one of the big city programs right now is cleaning out the weeds in the street medians. But what we look at in the watershed and in the river riparian zone even this year is we call it a clean and green. We go in and pick up garbage, and we also do thinning all the way down the river as much as we can. For instance, we're having one coming up June 22nd. We call it the Clean and Green program.
So people can get involved with that?
Yes. Go on our website, or they can call us at 820-1696.
Okay. And Laura, do you have any feeling for how organizations are maybe taking steps for future fire preparedness?
Well, I think that she brings up a really good point, not just with fire preparedness, but using opportunities this year that we don't always have in a dry year. And, you know, whether that's people remembering how to cooperate better and work together on future projects when there isn't as much water in the river or other rivers around the state, or thinking about future fire years. I think this year, in many ways, gives us kind of not a reprieve from our water challenges, certainly, but a moment to say, okay, what do we need to do to make sure we're ready for the next bad years, whether that's fire or water?
Okay. So, David, how does your organization make sure that you're kind of keeping a conservation mindset even in a year like this where there's loads of water?
Well, we are always water challenged here in New Mexico. It's just a fact of life for us. When we have a year of abundance like this, we don't waste water.
Mm-hmm.
We don't waste water anytime. And it's you get a lot of comments from people, pressure sometimes. Oh, there's no problem. There's plenty of water out there. Just fill up everything. You know, everything will be great. You can't do that. Okay. You have to be cognizant of it all the time. It has long-term implications on our compact deliveries. We deliver what we need to for our irrigators to grow their crops.
So this is just a fact of life.
It's just a fact of life, but we're never going into a wasteful mode. We always want to use just enough water, make sure the rest of it either goes down south to Elephant Butte for compact purposes or stays up north in a reservoir for next year.
And I think I have a comment here from a listener in Torrance County that I think kind of illustrates just how much variation we can have in New Mexico, even in a really wet year like this. They say that their well has run dry even with all the rain and snow this year. They haven't had water in the well for 45 days, and they're having to drill deeper to hit the water table. Is this going to be like typical in different corners of the states? Are there parts of our state that are experiencing, more of a drought condition than we're seeing here from, right next to the Rio Grande in Albuquerque. Laura?
Yeah, so the problems with groundwater depletion in parts of New Mexico is a really serious issue, and it's not something that can be fixed with one wet year or even a decade of wet years. Whether that's southeastern New Mexico and serious depletions of the Ogallala, or what people have been experiencing from Placitas across the back of the Sandias out to Estancia, we have some really serious problems with our groundwater in New Mexico. And I think that is that's kind of a hydrological reality, especially as we have not taken as much care of our aquifers and groundwater resources as we probably should have over the last few decades. But it's going to require some pretty serious discussions and changes at whether that's at the county level or the state level in terms of where and how groundwater is pumped in the state. And so we've covered that issue at New Mexico Political Report and at New Mexico in Focus. And the groundwater issues are very serious in many parts of New Mexico.
Now, Andy, in the Santa Fe watershed area, are there issues with, pollution or other contaminants in the water that become more of a problem in a year like this?
Well, I'm going to kind of piggyback on what Laura was saying. We have historic pollution sources from old injection wells and old projects that go into our aquifers. And so, yes, those are absolutely need to be monitored and they need to be mitigated. I think that a big part of all this is the groundwater mapping, not just for the toxic areas, but also for the whole groundwater on an ongoing basis, so we can actually monitor our groundwater. Now, the other thing that the other pollutant that has shown up for us here in the Santa Fe River has been E. coli. We actually were given a TMDL, total maximum daily load report, signed by the EPA in 2018, May, for an E. coli impairment. This shows up when you have more flows throughout the riparian zone and the arroyos. So it's a concern.
Now, David, you are a hydrologist. In an area like Albuquerque, we have, some high-profile plumes of contaminants in our water system, our groundwater. What does a high water year do for those things?
Probably has relatively little effect on them.
Okay.
The Rio Grande, at least through the valley here, of course, there's water moving in every year, mm-hmm. whether it's a high water year or whether it's releases from storage and it's being managed. So aquifer recharge is relatively constant from one year to the next. Now, our aquifers here through the valley have been rebounding as well because of the work of the Albuquerque Bernalillo County Water Utility Authority the last couple of decades. They've switched their management strategies. They've put in place a lot of conservation efforts, and they pump a whole lot less water from the aquifer than they used to. And as a result, because of the normal flows of the river, that aquifer is rebounding.
So for our listeners, I would like to know, how are you taking steps to maintain a conservation mindset in a year like this where we have loads of water, but we might not have it in the future? Do you have any tips that you could share with us for making the most of your water use? Please give us a call, 277-5866, or tweet using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. And I have a question from Mike. He emailed us. He wants to know how the high flows on the Rio Grande are affecting our legal responsibility to deliver water downstream to users under the Rio Grande Compact. We talked a little bit about this with the 1938 compact. Laura, are there other aspects to this issue that are being affected by this year?
Well, so the Rio Grande Compact is an interesting one in that the annual deliveries are based on what's happening upstream. And so it's kind of, forgive the bad pun, in some ways it's kind of a fluid compact. And so if there's more water upstream, then more water needs to be going downstream. And that's a hugely simplified answer. But I think the big issue to be watching rather than, or in addition to the flows of the Rio Grande this year, is to be keeping track and paying attention to what happens with the Supreme Court lawsuit on the Rio Grande, which will continue heating up this year, I believe.
Okay, now I have an email comment from Ian. He works a 3-acre farm in Albuquerque's South Valley called Chispas Farm. He says they're enjoying the wet spring, but global warming means access to clean water will continue to be a concern for them. They use traditional organic and regenerative grow farming techniques and plant a lot of different things to kind of hedge their bets on the weather. Andy, how can people take steps on their own to kind of be more prepared for, you know, a drier year in the future?
Well, of course, the classic, I'll say, domestic types of vehicles can be things like rain barrels. And then, of course, but before that, choosing your plantings around your house. Basically, you cannot count on high precipitation years, as David said. We're always in an arid situation here in New Mexico. And so choose your plants with that in mind. And then having rain barrels, having different catchment basins that you can build in your houses or on your property, and these will kind of create your own, if you want, mini pools of water that will help water your plants. We were involved in a study out at the community college, and a simple rain garden kept soil moisture at such a level to support plants throughout the year, regardless. And this was started in 2016 during some of the tough years. So those are simple things that you can do, are simple rain gardens. But before that, choosing your plants, I'll say, wisely.
Can you share some tips for making a rain garden in your own yard or what have you?
Sure. I think the biggest thing is to watch where your water is flowing off of your impervious surfaces like your roof and your driveway. That's the first thing, and you'll see where the water wants to be going. And so those are the places where you want to put in these basins. And then you can actually go on our website and see some samples, and we're about to have a video up there of how to build a backyard rain garden.
Okay, what is the website?
It's www.santafewatershed.org.
Okay. So, David, do you have any steps that you take in your own life for kind of making sure that you remain water minded in your day to day living?
Well, water is my world.
Yeah,
You notice it being used in so many different ways, and a lot of little things people don't think about. I'm listening to Andy's comments about rain gardens and stuff, and it's amazing how much more efficient all of us can be with water. And it doesn't mean that we have to xeriscape everything. We don't have to pave everything. There's lots of creative ways that we can keep green space and use water wisely. People need to be realistic about what they're trying to accomplish, how much water they use. And where I do see people with green space, and I'll include some of our farmers in this. A lot of our farmers are very efficient with water. But a lot of people tend to think, well, we'll just put more water in the ground. We'll store it there, okay? You really only need to be delivering what the crop or the plant can use in a given period of time between the next water delivery. There's a finite amount of water can be stored in the soil profile in the root zone. And there's science to all that, and it's not that difficult. And people can, if they educate themselves, they can apply the right amount of water, get the best possible plant growth, and not waste any. It's very easy to do.
So it's all about knowing your crops is what it sounds like.
Exactly.
In that case.
It's understanding. It's being realistic about what you're trying to accomplish.
Okay, thank you for joining us today for Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. We are talking about New Mexico's springtime rains and the importance of a conservation mindset, even when we have a year of abundance like this. We are going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment.
Composer Julia Perry suffered a stroke in 1971. Her right side was paralyzed, which meant she couldn't write with a pen or pencil. Perry taught herself to write down music with her left hand, so was able to continue composing. We'll celebrate the life and legacy of Julia Perry on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Skip the hassle of finding a buyer for that unwanted car. Donate it to KUNM and turn it into great radio. Or maybe you've got a truck, boat, or an RV you don't want anymore. Donate it to KUNM. It's very easy. It qualifies you for KUNM membership, and it helps KUNM a lot. Call today, 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are talking about New Mexico's watersheds, waterways, and water needs in this very wet year. Give us a call at 277-5866 or tweet using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. And we have a question from Diane in Arroyo Hondo. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
What is your question today?
Well, this question is in relation to plain water.
I'm sorry, Dan, you're kind of breaking up on me. Could you try the question again?
Yeah.
Sorry, Dan, I think we're going to ask you to call back. And if possible, if you could use a landline, it's just breaking up too much for us right now. We do absolutely want to hear from you, though, so please give us a call. So at this point, I'd like to welcome Paula Garcia into the conversation. Paula is the executive director of the New Mexico Acequia Association, an organization that preserves and protects New Mexico's historic network of irrigation canals, or acequias. Hi, Paula.
Good morning.
Good morning. And now, Paula, acequias have been an important part of New Mexico's irrigation system for centuries. Could you tell me a little bit about the cultural and community aspects of acequias?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Good morning, everybody. So I think the way you described acequias is apt. They're centuries-old irrigation communities that are comprised of families who share water from a common source, from one acequia. And the acequias are driven by a system of water sharing and by allocating water along the acequia to all the families who have water rights who share that particular acequia or irrigation ditch. And they have they've been in New Mexico for centuries, and a really important part of the acequias is what we call the repartimiento, which is the sharing of water. And it sounds simpler than it is. I think that there's some customary practices that are unique to each acequia and how they allocate the water among the neighboring families who have water rights on that particular acequia. But there are also customs of sharing and allocating water between acequias that share the same stream system. And so that's really, in that sense, the acequias are doing the same, very similar practices to what they've done for hundreds of years in New Mexico.
Could you tell me a little bit about some of these customs along the different acequias? Can you give me some examples?
Yeah. So, for example, acequias are very dynamic in the way that we respond to the different conditions each year. So, in a high flow year, the way that water is shared or allocated will be very different compared to a dry year. And so, for example, if I'm a farmer with 10 acre feet of water, and I have, or 10 acres of irrigated land, I might have 10 derechos, and I might have a certain amount of time for each derecho, each right. But in times of drought, the rotation gets smaller. So instead of getting 4 full days of drought, I might 4 full days of water, I might just get 1 day of water. And so the Mardomo of each acequia has to monitor how much water there is and adjust the irrigation schedule accordingly so that everybody gets some water and not one person or a few people can get most of the water. So we try to allocate the water as equitably as possible. And so it's also important to remember that just because I have 10 acres doesn't mean that I get enough water to irrigate my whole 10 acres. So in a dry year, I might only be able to irrigate a half an acre and have a garden. In a year like this, there's a better chance.
Who actually manages the water, makes these decisions for how that water is allocated in an acequia system?
Who makes the decision?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how does that get managed?
So acequias are governed by a three-member commission, elected commission, and a mardomo. But the mardomo is the person who's the day-to-day caretaker and allocator of water. But the approach that's used, or the policy, or the decision about how water should be allocated efficiently and equitably, is usually guided by the commission, and the mardomo is the person who implements and enforces and is on the ground making sure the water is getting to where it should be.
So the commission, do they take note of the local conditions and make their decision based on that?
Yeah, and it's a dynamic process, and every acequia is different. And in our acequia, the mardomo is the primary person who's making those determinations. And in a wet year, that the mardomo has a lot more flexibility in how he's able to meet the needs for everyone who's asking for water. And so that the mardomo will. In our case, we'll be making the decision for the most part, unless the commissioners decide to do it differently.
And how is this heavy water flow this year? How is that affecting acequia systems across the state?
Well, for the most part, having high water flow and high runoff is the ideal situation. It's really beautiful to have this much water, and having ample supplies of water really helps to ease tensions in the community. We've gone through years and year upon year of water shortage and drought, and to have this kind of year, it really lifts the spirits, I think, of farmers, because you're able to irrigate more of your land, or you're able to irrigate more frequently. So I think for the most part, there's a feeling of joy and feeling of that there's something great that's going to happen this year in terms of being able to grow crops and put land into production. At the same time, I think a lot of us are uneasy or unsettled about the long-term pattern. Where I'm from, Mora, we didn't get to irrigate one single time on our acequia last year because there was zero snowpack in our mountains. And so those memories kind of weigh heavy. And I think for some of us who are in water short situations, even when we have a good year, we're reluctant to put in new crops. So what we're doing is for that extra land that doesn't usually get water, we're just putting it in cover crops. And, I'm not putting in more asparagus or, more raspberries or something. I'm saying, no, I'm going to keep that in cover crop because, next year I might just have a really bad drought year again. So we're just trying to balance the risk and try to be realistic and mindful about the bigger pattern while we at the same time enjoy what we do have. And I think a lot of farmers are thinking more about how to build better soils, to build healthy soil, because healthy soil retains more moisture. And so I think a lot of us are using strategies of focusing attention on sometimes smaller pieces of land or putting in regenerative practices so that on rangeland or on the broader pieces of land so that when the dry years do hit, our farms and ranches will be more resilient to those dry spells.
Now, I'd like to take a call from Danny in Bernalillo. Hi, Danny.
Oh, hi. Good morning.
Hi there. What would you like to add to the conversation now?
Well, I came here. One second. I got an incoming hold. End.
Okay. Why don't we come back to you, Danny? So I have a question for you, David. Does the Middle Rio Grande Conservancy District incorporate acequias into its methods or outlook?
Yes. When the Conservancy District was formed back in the 1920s, there were something on the order of 75 to 80 acequias already existing here in the Middle Rio Grande Valley. And we were not developed from a clean sheet of paper. There were acequias going back to the 1600s here in the valley. And we just incorporated those acequias into what became the MRGCD today. So we are, in some ways, you could kind of look at us as a giant acequia or maybe a modified acequia. We manage water similar in a lot of ways to acequias, but there are also some differences, primary of which is because we do have some supplemental storage, which most acequias do not. A few do, but most don't. We can operate more as a demand-based system, try and deliver water on demand to irrigators versus acequias, which are primarily supply driven. They can't really control their supply, so they split it up in equal parcels to all of their users.
Right.
And it's just a little bit, a subtle twist on the philosophy there.
So, Paula, how has the acequia system adapted to deal with the challenges of climate change and kind of fluctuations of the years? Are there steps taken to kind of modernize this ancient system?
Yeah, by all means. There are a lot of conversations happening about how acequias need to be adapting to climate change, and it's happening at the local level. It's happening around the kitchen table. And I think, first of all, farmers are trying to adapt in terms of their cropping patterns or, like I said, building healthy soils. But at the acequia level, as I mentioned before, there are these centuries-old customs for sharing water and allocating water equitably, and those are resilient customs. They've stood the test of time. At the same time, we're also seeing longer stretches of dry years and more intense drought. And so acequias are having to go back and have that conversation and revisit their customs and see if they're really working for them. In some cases, having to reinvent their customs. And so the idea of a custom is having to become more adaptable, more dynamic than just saying, okay, it's a fixed way of allocating water, that the acequia has to look at that, give that another look and see, okay, given this condition of even less water, how are we adapting our water sharing customs? And so in a way, they're doing what they've always done. They're adapting to what's there, but at the same time, I think the intensity of the drought is causing people to really rethink how they share water and implementing different kinds of adaptations and different kinds of rotations, because acequias need a certain amount of pressure head to get water through the ditch, and so if you're in a valley or a basin where you have numerous acequias sharing the same stream system, the acequias have to figure out how many acequias can be open and still have enough water to get to move the water through the ditch. And for example, in the Rio Chama last year, you had 17 acequias below Abiquiu having to all close their head gates partially and getting less water until they had to actually put them on a rotation where some were open 3 days versus some were open the other 4 days. And then later in the season, when it got really bad, the lower acequias got most of the water for the 4 days, and the other 14 acequias had to share water the other 3 days. So
okay.
Let me go ahead and jump
in here, Paula. We've got one last call from Danny in Bernalillo. Hi, Danny.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. What would you like to add today?
Well, I have 8.5 acres of deeded irrigated land. We've been here 40 years. We're north of Bernalillo. So, you know, if you when you fly into Albuquerque, most of this valley is alfalfa and permanent pasture, which is what we've had. So here's the question. It seems insane to me the amount of water, which is probably thousands and thousands of gallons of water, I'm allowed to flood my land with to grow hay for horses or for cows or whatever it goes for. Cows are notorious for putting out methane, which is bad. We've put in some Alamo trees, which are carbon sinks. And the question is alfalfa a carbon sink? Do these grasses help? You'd like to see this water doing something good for the environment. I mean, I wish it was all cucumbers, but I'm 75 years old. And so that's the issue, really. In addition, I got a government grant, which was part of the Farm Bill, of $35,000 to level the fields. I didn't get the money, but this is your tax dollars to small farmers going to, quote, save water. And the ditches are notorious. They're leaking. I mean, our irrigation system needs millions of dollars to keep it from just wasting water. So,
okay, thanks, Danny. I'm going to go ahead and take this to Paula. Paula, how can you talk about leaking acequias and maybe the consideration that is necessary in growing different kinds of crops?
Sure. Yeah, I think, first of all, on the idea of seepage, there's actually some interesting work being done on how important that seepage is to aquifer recharge. And so although it can seem inefficient to water deliveries, that seepage actually can have some beneficial purposes as well. And that research has been done by NMSU, the Water Resources Research Institute. But I think as a society, we do need to find a balance and whether an irrigation system moves toward concrete lined or piping, I think it's a local decision, and there are several acequias that are going in that direction, and for the reason that they've prioritized delivery over the benefits of the seepage. But it's an economic decision, and it's a aesthetic decision, about what the community prefers. So I think that's a good topic to delve into more. When it comes to carbon sequestration, there was a really interesting bill passed at the New Mexico Legislature called the Healthy Soils Act that's going to be encouraging farmers to, or providing incentives for farmers to do what's sometimes called carbon farming, and trying to keep ground cover on your land as opposed to tilling it every year and replanting it, which releases carbon and keeping a cover crop. And
Paula, we've got the music starting, so that does mean it's all the time we have today. I just want to thank everyone who called in to share your thoughts or emailed or what have you, and thank you so much to our guests today. The conversation does not have to end here. You can share your thoughts by commenting on KUNM.org or email us at letstalk@KUNM.org. If you missed part of the show, you can stream it online or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. I'm Ty Bannerman. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Kaveh Movahed screened your calls, and Bryce Dix live tweeted the show. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.